I realize that many want to know something about me now.
An unexpected selection to replace one of the most prominent cardinals in the United States. We go on the record with the Pope's pick to lead the Archdiocese of Boston. The presidential tickets are now set. What Catholic voters need to know about the vice presidential nominee's stance on the life issue.
What are your thoughts on the dating culture in 2024?
I feel like as a Catholic man, you really have to learn to balance what you're looking for.
Would you say that dating now is harder than it was, say, 20 years ago?
Oh, yes. Yes.
The comment from one of the candidates about childless cat ladies sparks a national debate about dating, marriage, and family. Some leading Catholic thought leaders share their insights. And we go inside the food ministry of a Catholic priest and chef providing physical and spiritual nourishment, one meal at a time. EWTN News in Depth starts now.
I was deeply shocked and surprised by this call. But I know the goodness of God suffices in all things. I will trust in Him. God bless the Archdiocese of Boston.
A surprise announcement as Pope Francis appoints a new leader to replace one of America's most influential cardinals and one of the most prominent archdioceses in the U.S. Welcome to EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. With almost 2 million Catholics, Boston is one of the largest and oldest archdioceses in the United States. And this week, Pope Francis appointed Providence, Rhode Island's Bishop Richard Henning as Boston's next archbishop. As longtime shepherd, Cardinal Sean O'Malley is set to retire as Archbishop of Boston at age 80. Cardinal O'Malley was installed as the Archbishop of Boston back in 2003 and elevated to cardinal in 2006. A vocal leader in confronting clerical sex abuse in the church, O'Malley took the helm of the archdiocese at the height of its grappling with its clerical sex abuse scandal and was ultimately tasked with heading the Pontifical Commission for the Protection of Minors. O'Malley reflected on his long tenure at a press conference this week.
My 20 years in Boston have been challenging, wonderful years in many respects, but when I arrived, it was at a time of great crisis and great pain because of the terrible scourge of sexual abuse. But despite all of the challenges that we have, I am filled with hope. And I see the faith of our people.
Archbishop-elect Henning will be installed as Archbishop of Boston on October 31st. Before the announcement, speculation over whom O'Malley's replacement would be had been a topic of discussion for years, and many church watchers expressed surprise at Pope Francis's pick.
One reason is that it's a surprise is that Bishop Henning has only been a bishop for 6 years.
Many were caught off guard about a lesser-known prelate with such a short tenure as bishop being picked to lead the fourth-largest archdiocese in the United States. EWTN senior Vatican analyst Francis Rocca explains the Pope's decision reflects his other appointments.
Pope Francis likes to be unpredictable. He likes a surprise. In some ways, this pick is characteristic of Francis's choices of many bishops. He hasn't spent a lot of time in Rome. He spent a lot of time in parishes as a pastor. He hasn't spent a lot of time in the chancery and didn't work in the Roman Curia. So in that way, he's characteristic of Francis' bishop.
Daniel Salucci is CEO of the Catholic Leadership Institute, which provides leadership training to nearly 300 bishops and more than 120 dioceses. He believes Pope Francis had the needs of his flock in mind when making this choice.
He's bilingual and that he has deep roots in the Latino community and how important that is and has been in the church in Boston and only growing.
Some of the biggest challenges Henning will contend with at the helm of the archdiocese, the continued effects of Boston's clerical sex abuse scandal, as well as a growing secularization in the culture.
I think Archbishop Henning is well suited to continue to embrace and lean into kind of the challenges of growing secularization. I think New England and Northeast in particular, the culture is not with us.
And while Henning is not a cardinal like his predecessor, O'Malley was not either when he first took on the job.
Jury might still be out relative to what the future might hold. I think it seems like the Holy Father is really looking at the needs of the church universal and trying to decide by way of, designating those cardinal sees differently. But I don't know that it rules out that the Archdiocese of Austin might still be one down the road.
To talk about his new role and the faith that Pope Francis has placed in his stewardship of the Archdiocese of Boston, we are joined now on the record by the incoming Archbishop himself, His Excellency Archbishop-elect Richard Henning.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Your Excellency. Thank you for joining us this week, and please know of our prayers amid this announcement. How and when did you first learn of your new appointment? You said you were deeply shocked by the call.
Yes. So I was coming back from the office and preparing to go out to one of our parishes to receive a gentleman into the Catholic faith that I had gotten to know in my first year in Providence, a man of really great integrity and faith who felt drawn to the Catholic Church. So it was kind of an exciting afternoon. I was looking forward to that. And the nuncio called me just as I arrived back in my room. And, they have that expression, in the movies, you better sit down for this. Well, that was the first time in my life I understood what they were talking about. I had to sit down for that one. Mm-hmm. I just was so surprised, with only a year in as the diocesan bishop, I never expected a call like that. And I've gotten them before, but I just presumed that he was calling about another matter. So it took me a few minutes to make sense of what he was asking me. But the honest truth is, it's just the way my parents raised me. It's how I understand, my call as a bishop. I don't say no, to the Holy Father, certainly. Mm-hmm. And so I felt that it was my duty to say yes. I struggled to understand this one because of the short period of time. But I trust in God, and I trust that the Holy Father and the Nuncio have the larger picture, and that therefore it is my duty to kind of respond as fully and freely as I can to that call. Mm. So.
And I think a lot of people were surprised by that announcement as well. And people can be quick to want to define bishops with either a conservative or a liberal label. So for those who are learning about you for the first time, Your Excellency, how would you describe yourself? What do you want people to know?
Well, what I said at the press conference was, I'm a sinner in need of grace. So I have to admit that personally, I resist those kinds of categories, because I think the honest truth is they don't really accord with the depth and the breadth of the church's own life and ministry engagement in the culture. It tends to see only the surface, the social or political elements of a person's life or of society itself. And it strikes me that God asks more of us, and that the church's tradition is so much more than that. And it really doesn't matter which faction people claim to belong to. I'm to be pastor to all of them. So I feel it's important to be very clear that my first, my first identity really is as a disciple of Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. And obviously that has implications and, for how I engage or anyone else would engage in the world around us. So I'm not suggesting that we, live off in a land of our own. We have to engage in society. But I think we always have to come to that engagement as best we can from the point of view of the gospel, which is always, again, looking beyond the surface, looking for the depths. So I don't know that I would like to kind of claim a category, if that's all right with you. I'm not being evasive when I say that. It's more just my sense of duty as a priest of Jesus Christ and as a disciple who is striving to be faithful to his will.
Absolutely. And you are walking into one of the country's most prominent archdioceses and following in the footsteps of Cardinal Sean O'Malley, who has served in Boston for more than 20 years. I'd like to give you a moment to comment on your predecessor's legacy in Boston and in the wider church.
All right. So I don't mean this in any way, you know, blasphemously, but I have felt a few times in the last few weeks like, this must be what Peter must have felt like after the Lord's ascension. You know, like I don't have any illusions that I am going to live up to the example that His Eminence has set. I've admired him for many years. He has done not only extraordinary work in ministry for the people of Boston and the Archdiocese, but really, truly, in this case, around the world, and certainly of service to the Universal Church and to the Holy Father. So I stand in awe of his own qualities of fidelity, his biblical preaching, his humility, his devotion to the Holy Father and to the Church. So I certainly will try to imitate his example, but I will come, I guess, with the desire now to surrender myself, you know, to this new ministry. That's kind of the way I handle it. I know that Boston is a large archdiocese, and therefore, as you said, it's considered prominent. But I think my mission is going to be the people in front of me, and that's where my focus is going to begin and hopefully remain. You know, when I was at the Eucharistic Congress, which was a deeply moving experience, the Bishop of Brownsville, Bishop Daniel Flores, gave an address to the bishops and priests on the poverty of Christ and talking about that sense in which Christ gives himself completely in love and trust to our Heavenly Father for the sake of the world. And he was talking about, for us as ordained ministers of the gospel, that same call. So to me, this summons by the Holy Father and this now, you know, kind of mission that I believe God has entrusted to me is a call to forget myself, to abandon myself, to pour myself out for the sake of this church. Now, I understand the world, in the real world, that also means administrative responsibilities and lots of bureaucracy and all of that. But I think I wouldn't serve anyone very well if that were really my beginning. I think the beginning has to be with the Lord, with the gift of the Eucharist, and with a love for his people, and to go there with an open heart and mind, to hear them, to learn about their own faithful witness and the many ways in which good people are you know, living the faith on a daily basis, and sort of join in that mission with them, I think.
Absolutely. And we'll be praying for you along the way. We're out of time, but I have one last question, and this is just a one or two word answer. You're a New York man moving to Boston. So, Your Excellency, Yankees or Red Sox?
Okay, so I'm going to slip out of that one. Well, I was never a Yankees fan, so that I'm a little bit safer. I grew up a Mets fan. My other family members are Yankees fans. So that's a very difficult one for me. So I think the stance I'm going to take going in is, let's let the Red Sox win a World Series, then maybe I'll convert. How's that?
Very diplomatic. Your Excellency, we're praying for you in this transition. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Catherine. God bless you.
God bless. Still to come, from the selection of an important new leader for the Catholic Church to selection of running mates on the presidential tickets. Next, how Governor Tim Walz and Senator J.D. Vance will back up the top of their tickets on some issues critical to Catholic voters.
I know a number of single women who had always hoped to be married and have children who have just sworn off dating altogether.
Reality for a single Catholic person searching for a life partner from a Catholic perspective. Reaction to the national conversation about childlessness.
Feeding those, not just who are hungry in body, but mind and soul, really changes people.
And the importance of the bread of life. We go on the road and in the kitchen with Father Leo Padalinghug,
EWTN News in Depth will be right back. The Republicans and Democrats' presidential tickets are now set. And both the Trump and Harris campaigns confirmed this week there will be a debate between the two candidates on September 10th on the ABC network, with possibly more to come. With just 3 short months to go before the November election, Kamala Harris introduced her vice presidential pick, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, at a campaign rally in Philadelphia on Tuesday night.
In 91 days... of the United States.
Before entering into politics, Walz was a high school social studies teacher and football coach in Minnesota. In 2006, he won a seat in Congress and represented a conservative, rural, and historically Republican district for 12 years before running for governor. He is now in his second term. Walz was also a member of the Army National Guard for 24 years and was the highest-ranking enlisted soldier to ever serve in Congress. Donald Trump's choice to be his running mate on the Republican ticket, first-term Senator J.D. Vance of Ohio, was quick to comment on his Democratic rival. Also a veteran, Vance served 4 years in the Marine Corps out of high school before graduating from the Ohio State University and Yale Law School. The author of the best-selling book Hillbilly Elegy, which is about his upbringing, Vance also stakes a claim to knowing something about America's heartland.
We're white guys from the Midwest. I guess there are similarities there. But what's different is the actual ideas about how best to serve people, white, black, or anything else, in the Midwest and everywhere else.
This week, Vance was on the campaign trail making solo stops in some of the same battleground states that Harris and Walz blitzed through, to include Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, Arizona, and Nevada. The vice presidential candidate's view and record on the life issue of such importance to Catholic voters and how that reflects on the top of the ticket is the focus of this report from our own Mark Irons.
With Minnesota Governor Tim Walz now added to the Democratic presidential ticket this week.
Thank you, Madam Vice President, for the trust you put in me.
I absolutely want to debate Tim Walz.
Catholics can take a closer look at both Walz and Republican vice presidential nominee J.D. Vance and compare them side by side, starting with their faith backgrounds. Walz was raised Catholic. He is now Lutheran. In his first speech as running mate, he spoke about the formative values his parents instilled.
My mom and dad taught us, show generosity towards your neighbors and work for a common good.
Vance is a convert to Catholicism. In November 2023, the U.S. Senator from Ohio appeared on EWTN Pro-Life Weekly and reflected on what he called the fundamental insight leading to his conversion.
It's the fundamental Christian insight that every human being has dignity.
To learn more about some of the issues of concern for Catholic voters, we reached out to organizations that serve as a public policy voice for the church. The Catholic conferences in Minnesota and Ohio spoke about their perspectives. After Minnesota's governor was named the Democratic vice presidential pick, Jason Adkins, the executive director of the Minnesota Catholic Conference, in a public statement assured Walz of their prayers and said, "We are proud to have worked together with him to enact a nation-leading child tax credit and promote the well-being of immigrant Minnesotans. Yet we also have had areas of strong disagreement, including protecting the innocent unborn from abortion, the protection of children from the manifestation of gender ideology, and the importance of parental rights in education. In some areas, such as religious liberty, we've appreciated his willingness to hear our concerns and change course." Regarding Vance, the Catholic Conference of Ohio gave EWTN News in Depth a statement saying, "We have appreciated Senator Vance's expressions of support for a child tax credit and broader assistance for families. Additionally, we appreciated Senator Vance's outspokenness about the dignity of work and the sanctity of life during our campaign to protect unborn children last year." While the Catholic Conference of Ohio mainly focuses on statewide policy, it expressed that Senator Vance has listened to their promotion of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops' policy positions on federal issues, including on areas of disagreement. The statement concluded, "We keep Senator Vance and all the 2024 candidates in our prayers that they will seek a better kind of politics that allows for respectful dialogue with individuals of different political convictions and seeks the integral human development of all, no matter their stage of development or country of origin, even when it's not politically convenient." On the issue of abortion, Vance's position seems to have changed. First, he said this last year while speaking about his Catholic convictions and the dignity of all human life.
And I think that means we have to fight for good wages for people who work hard for a living. That means that we have to fight hard for the vulnerable. That means that we have to fight hard for people who can't access health care, because, of course, hard to live a dignified life when you can't afford basic medicine. But that really means in this moment, I think, fighting for the unborn, the most vulnerable among us, the health care that they need, the legal protections that they need in order to live a full life.
But prior to his selection as Donald Trump's running mate, and around the same time the Republican Party rolled back some of the pro-life language in its 2024 party platform, Vance said he supports access to mifepristone, a drug used in chemical abortions, which made up more than half of U.S. abortions last year, according to the Guttmacher Institute. The Trump campaign defends the 2022 reversal of Roe v. Wade at the Supreme Court. The former president says states should decide on abortion. But Walls doesn't believe Trump.
He said he'd ban abortion across this country, and he'll do it, whether or not Congress is there or not.
Walls has expanded and secured access to abortion in the state of Minnesota. As governor, he signed laws removing abortion restrictions and made it easier for those living outside Minnesota to get an abortion there. He also signed an executive order making it easier for those seeking transgender procedures to access them in Minnesota. Abortion advocates are pleased with Walls' addition to the Democratic ticket. Alexis McGill Johnson, the president and CEO of Planned Parenthood, described her approval, calling the pairing of Harris and Walls a match made at Planned Parenthood. In March, Vice President Kamala Harris visited a Planned Parenthood abortion clinic in Minnesota. Governor Walls stood behind her in support.
So I'm here at this health care clinic to uplift the work that is happening in Minnesota as an example of what true leadership looks like.
The White House said the visit was believed to be the first time a president or vice president has ever visited an abortion clinic. Meanwhile, the group Susan B. Anthony Pro-Life America says Kamala Harris and Tim Walz make up the most pro-abortion presidential ticket America has ever seen. It's possible voters will have a chance to see the vice presidential hopefuls go head-to-head in the near future. Both Walz and Vance have expressed their willingness to debate. Mark Irons, EWTN News In Depth.
Both of the vice presidential candidates have become famous for coining phrases that have hit a nerve. Walls for labeling the top of the Republican ticket as weird, and Vance for calling some leading Democrats, quote, childless cat ladies. When we come back, a deeper dive into that childless comment in a church that places great value on family, children, and the vocation of marriage. We share thoughts about that from those living the childless, single, Catholic life.
What do you think of the dating culture in 2024?
There is no dating culture in 2024.
Would you like to elaborate?
I would say that men are canceled.
It was a lot easier for me, like, in a college environment and after graduating college and going into the young professional world, it's gotten a lot harder.
In college, it was hard to find someone who really wanted, like, a long-term and genuine relationship. Most of the people I dated was, like, a one-time thing, and they didn't want anything super serious.
In a society where finding Mr. or Mrs. Right is becoming increasingly difficult, where the number of singles has spiked and marriage rates have plummeted, it's not easy to settle down, marry, and start a family. That empty crib is as true for faithful Catholics seeking the vocation of marriage as it is for the general population. So when comments J.D. Vance made a few years ago resurfaced recently, criticizing childless people, it hit a nerve, spiraling into a nationwide conversation. Here's a clip of what he said as a then-Senate candidate on Fox News in 2021.
We're effectively run in this country via the Democrats, via our corporate oligarchs, by a bunch of childless cat ladies who are miserable at their own lives and the choices that they've made, and so they want to make the rest of the country miserable too. And it's just a basic fact. You look at Kamala Harris, Pete Buttigieg, AOC, the entire future of the Democrats is controlled by people without children. And how does it make any sense that we've turned our country over to people who don't really have a direct stake in it? I just wanted to ask that question and propose that maybe if we want a healthy ruling class in this country, we should invest more, we should vote more, we should support more people who actually have kids.
we should note Kamala Harris is a stepmother of two. The media frenzy over Vance's comments point to a broader conversation on the role of marriage and family in America at a time when our shrinking fertility rate has hit a historic low. According to the latest data from the CDC's National Center for Health Statistics, the United States saw almost 3.6 million births recorded in 2023, a 2% decline from 2022. That's a fertility rate at 1.62 births per woman, the lowest point in more than 50 years, and well below the replacement point of 2.1. Those low birth rates mirror the downward trend of marriage. The center's latest data shows there are just over six marriages for every 1,000 people in the United States, compared to a record 16.4 in 1946 after World War II. Many Americans are getting married later than ever. Pew Research found that in 2021, a quarter of 40-year-olds in the U.S. had never been married. When you begin to dig into the why behind the lower marriage and fertility rates, the reasons people cite can vary from economic concerns to focusing on their career. But there are also singles out there who desire marriage and children and say it's out of their control with the state of the modern day dating culture. This week, we wanted to explore what that Catholic dating culture looks like today. When we asked women to describe what it's like to date in 2024, they tell us,
it's dry, dull, nothing is out here.
Difficult.
Complicated.
Tragic.
The reasons, they say, vary.
I think with the dating apps, it makes it a little bit more difficult because it creates more of a shallow environment.
Everybody's on different pages. Nobody wants the same thing at the same time. Everybody's like taught to kind of be more independent when a relationship is supposed to be together.
Catholics are not immune from these very challenges. The Catholic marriage rate plummeted by about 70% between 1969 and 2019, according to a recent report from Georgetown University's Center for Applied Research in the Apostolate. There's even a popular Instagram account, Catholic Dating Nightmares, documenting the cringeworthy encounters that range from the awkward to the downright offensive.
I just say it's really bad out there. It's really bad out there.
Sarah Perla is communications manager for the Catholic Project at the Catholic University of America. Wanting to address long-term challenges facing the church, the Catholic Project hosted a panel on why Catholic dating is so hard, featuring six unmarried Catholics at the recent National Eucharistic Congress in Indianapolis. Hundreds of people attended.
So I did a survey both before and after, and the number one challenge that the single people were complaining of is just meeting someone. I can't just be Catholic. I can't just meet a Catholic guy. I have to be a Catholic guy who is interesting and who is interested in me.
On top of her professional insight into today's dating culture, Perla shares a personal perspective as well, as a single Catholic woman in her early 40s, a perspective that's all the more valuable given recent national discussion.
Well, I think we should just mention the whole childless cat lady thing. It's interesting that women are blamed for the situation in a way that I think is very unfair, because we still want to be pursued. And if we're not pursued, then there's not a lot we can do.
Perla says one of the greatest challenges to Catholic dating today is finding someone who is both a well-formed Catholic and someone you can connect with.
It's a mistake that some people make when they try to set people up and they say, like, oh, he's Catholic. And you're like, that doesn't tell me much at all. Is he funny? Does he have interests? Does he do anything outside of read theology? Because if not, then we're not going to have anything to talk about.
I didn't expect to be single into my 40s. That was not my plan.
Anastasia Northrup shares both a personal and professional insight into the dating world as well, as a single Catholic woman in her 40s and founder of the National Catholic Singles Conference.
I started the conference really with the aspect of idea of formation, helping form people, but then also there's the aspect of community. Over the years, I've seen how important that is. You know, we're called to communion, we're called to fellowship, and we don't live our faith on our own or in a vacuum. And so, especially as single people that don't have that built-in family community, having relationships and friendships is very important.
That community, Northrop says, is essential for single Catholics to embrace the gift of the present moment and their calling to love others now.
People did not expect to be single this long. They expected to just grow up and get married and have a family. And then they find themselves, mid-30s and, where's my husband and my kids?
Both Northrop and Perla encourage local Catholic parishes to be more intentional in including unmarried Catholics and of fostering community among singles, as these members of our church continue to pray and see God's plan for their life unfold.
To help us go in depth into the topic of dating and the lower marriage and fertility rates, we're joined now by two Catholics who have written extensively on the topic. Emily Stimson Chapman is a writer for a variety of Catholic institutions and a best-selling author. Among her books, The Catholic Girl's Survival Guide for the Single Years, The Nuts and Bolts of Staying Sane and Happy While Waiting for Mr. Right. We're also joined by J.P. DeGance, founder and president of Communio, a group that consults with churches on how to solve our nation's family and faith crisis. He's also co-author of the book Endgame, The Church's Strategic Move to Save Faith and Family in America. Thank you both for being here. Emily, I want to start with you. You've been open about your personal journey as someone who got married in your 40s. You faced infertility, and now you're the adoptive mother to three and a wife as well. When we talk about childless women in our nation, particularly this conversation spurred on by J.D. Vance's resurfaced comments about childless cat ladies, what is missing from this wider conversation?
Charity and compassion, which are pretty much the same two things missing from most public conversations. And it's true. We have to have a conversation about this. The demographic numbers are chilling. There are real concerns about why people are not getting married. But when we talk about it, we have to be charitable for all those women out there who are doing their best and seeking God's will and hoping for marriage and babies, but it's not happening. And we have to be compassionate for people who have chosen freely not to have kids and have done so out of their own woundedness or struggles. Like, we need to remember them too and speak with charity and compassion, because nobody's going to listen to us if we don't. Like, if we actually want to reach people, we might not want to call them childless.
And it's important context. Pew Research cites the number one reason people don't have kids is they just don't want to have children. JP, this impacts men as well. You authored a national study on faith and relationships. What are you hearing specifically from single men when it comes to this topic of dating and marriage?
Well, a huge factor is, men, there aren't a lot of single men showing up in church, right? In our survey, the Nationwide Study on Faith and Relationships, there are 42% more never married women in church on Sunday than men in church on Sunday. When we talk with pastors, we talk with parish leaders, a big message to us is, as the local parish, the local church, how are we attracting men into the life of the church? That's a huge need for us. I think of my parents who met and married in 1968, a fairly revolutionary year in our culture. And when they met a few years earlier, they met in a CYO dance that was held weekly at their parish, right? Our parishes used to be places where there was more than just Mass and the sacraments provided. There was a place of community where folks of both sexes could meet, form friendships, and build community. That's really missing in our individual parishes. Mm-hmm.
Something I heard from my interviewees is today men and women often have mismatched expectations when dating. Decades ago, you could often assume expectations. Women would stay home once married, for example, but today there is no script. I'm interested in your thoughts on that modern day factor. Emily, I'll go to you first.
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously a problem, but we all have expectations going into marriage of some sort. I think the problem is not just mismatched expectations, but holding on to those expectations too tightly. Like, we forget that, you fall in love with a person, not a list, and God calls you to a vocation, not a lifestyle. But for a whole host of reasons, maybe social media, maybe dating app sites, I often see single people going into dating looking for someone who's checking all the boxes.
Yeah.
And that doesn't leave God room to move and surprise you and set you on a path with a person who is good and wise and kind and maybe doesn't want on the first date to homeschool. But, if you get to know them, you find that it is exactly the person who can help you journey to heaven. Mm.
JP, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. When I was dating and eventually met my wife, I had this long list myself of what I thought would be the ideal spouse. And I met my wife and she was missing so many of those things that I thought were incredibly important. Thank God for it. Mm-hmm. I saw Anastasia Northrup. I was with her in her conference. And mm-hmm. when I looked at my own list, I started to realize that the list that I had built looked a lot like me. I was looking for a female version of JP, and realized that complementarity was so important. My wife is so different from me in many of the ways that I need her to be different from me, and she's helped me grow so much as a result. Mm. Now, I think a big factor that's at work here with these different cultural narratives that are going on can be summarized in this idea of expressive individualism, right? It's been commented on from guys like Dr. Brad Wilcox and others, where we seek in modernity, we want to seek happiness as its own end and as its own good. And the ancients would have been surprised to see that actually happiness is oftentimes the byproduct of a journey and a quest. And there's historically in human history, the journey of family life was that normative journey. And so many folks are parents, Catholic parents, as well as non-Christians and non-Catholics, were frequently sharing the same cultural narratives and not even aware of it, where we encourage our kids to seek advanced degrees, seek great things, careers, and stuff oftentimes, and that marriage is sort of diminished in importance within the narratives we share with our kids. And what we share, I coach a football team. I share that with a bunch of high school boys and my own children, that be intentional about dating. Be intentional about, don't avoid commitment. Mm. While career is important, it's a good thing. Getting a great degree is a good thing. These are all good things. Statistically speaking, nothing impacts a person's happiness more than being in a happy marriage. We should be intentional about it. And I hear from 15-year-old boys and 16-year-old boys I coach and share that this is the first time they're hearing this. So I think we need to share this message as well.
Absolutely. Emily, you wrote a helpful Substack newsletter largely on this topic that you called a vocational primer for people who have delayed vocations, for Catholics who are single today and desiring marriage. What are they to do? And does the church offer any guidance on this?
The church offers to singles the same guidance she offers to all of us, and that's to do God's will. And during, I was spent most of my 20s and my 30s single, and what helped me the most was just always remembering that God's will is in the present. Like, God's will is not some far off future. Like, God has a will for me today. Like, he has people for me to love today. He has work he has for me to do today. He has things he wants me to learn today, and he wants me to love him and grow in holiness today. And so when you are focused on seeking God's will in the moment and doing what he has for you on that day, God will use that to prepare you for your vocation and lead you to your vocation if that is something that's possible. But really, it's just following the church's advice to everyone. Mm-hmm. That's to seek Christ first and know that you are being loved in this moment and not just a future day. Mm.
JP, you've hit on this already, but what should the parish be doing to reverse these marital trends?
I think we should take a page out of the vocations playbook around the priesthood. I think there's a vocations director in almost every diocese being intentional about thinking through the encouragement priestly vocations. The real vocations crisis, statistically speaking, is marriage. There's the number of priestly ordinations is down about 38%, as you shared earlier in the segment. The sacramental marriages are down nearly about 72% over that same time frame. And we can be, there's a lot at the individual parish that we can and should be doing to encourage community amongst heterogeneous groups, married and single building. I think one of the things that we do is when we work at the parish, we think about building that that living room in the parish, the type of events where there might be a dance night. You bring in a dance instructor, you bring in singles, you bring in married, you allow people, you have something substantive shared at that session around relationships, and allow people to meet each other in person. Mm-hmm. Outside of these apps, outside of online interaction, we need real, authentic, person-to-person, flesh-and-blood community. The parish can and should be the place for that. We can't we can't throw up our hands at the local parish. We can't curse the darkness and throw our shoes at the TVs. We got to own the problem in our own parish by being the solution locally.
Absolutely. Emily, we have less than a minute, but I just want to give you this last question. I'm just struck by the hard truth that no one is entitled to marriage and no one is entitled to children, but it can feel for so many like Jesus isn't listening to them. Can you just reflect on that for a moment?
Oh yeah. I mean, I totally felt that way for so long. I was like, Lord, I did everything right. I followed your commandments. I lived my life the way I thought you wanted me to live it. And there's no husband. And then there was a husband, but no babies. And it was an important moment for me, not just to realize that husbands and babies are gifts. They're not rights, but that gifts aren't just the things we want. You know, I thought God wasn't blessing me when I didn't have a husband. And I felt like he wasn't blessing me when I didn't have babies. But he was blessing me through all that. Mm. Like, infertility is one of God's greatest gifts to me, because I wouldn't be the mother to my children if not for it. All those single years were a tremendous blessing because they prepared me for the life that I'm living now. Mm. And so just to see, like, it's not just about rights and gifts, but it's about blessings, and all the hard stuff is a blessing too, even though it doesn't feel like it in the moment.
Well said. Well, Emily and JP, I'm so grateful for you both in this robust discussion. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Catherine.
Thanks, Catherine.
Top headlines are next in the Week in Review. Tensions are high in the Middle East as expectations mount about the possibility of a regional war. That news tops our headlines in the Week in Review. This as diplomats from the region and in the U.S. try to tamp down those tensions and revive discussions about a ceasefire in Gaza. The region is at a boiling point after recent Israeli strikes in both Lebanon and Iran, targeting Hezbollah and Hamas leaders and other militants. Angry mourners at their funerals have chanted slogans of hatred towards Israel. In the meantime, Israeli strikes in Gaza continue. Overnight strikes this week hit tents being used as temporary shelters by displaced Palestinians in the courtyard of a hospital in the central Gaza Strip. This as Israel ordered another mass evacuation of Palestinians in southern Gaza, where the Israeli army warns it plans to launch renewed operations. As the situation continues to deteriorate, Israel is bracing for potential retaliatory strikes from Iran, angry over the assassination on its soil of Hamas's political leader. Arab and U.S. diplomats are urging Iran to exercise restraint and for Israel and Hamas to reopen ceasefire discussions in a scramble to avoid escalating the situation into a broader war that would further destabilize the region. The United Nations announced it has fired 9 staff members from its Agency for Palestinian Refugees, known as UNRWA. An internal investigation found they might have been involved in the Hamas-led attack against Israel on October 7th. UNRWA is the main agency providing aid to Palestinians in Gaza. The initial accusations came from the Israeli government. The UN Secretary General's office did not elaborate on what role the staffers played on the attack on Israel, which resulted in the deaths of more than 1,200 people and the abduction of 250 others. A judge has ruled that Harvard University must face an anti-Semitism lawsuit. He said in his decision the school, quote, failed its Jewish students. This decision, just months after pro-Palestinian protests, upended student life on campus. The case was brought by Jewish students who say the school was indifferent towards their safety concerns over anti-Semitic harassment. The Ivy League university attempted to dismiss the lawsuit, but the judge ruled on Tuesday that the case will move forward. This lawsuit is just one of many accusing major universities of allowing anti-Semitism on campus amidst pro-Palestinian activities. A federal judge ruled this week that Google broke the law to maintain its online monopoly. The decision is a major blow to the search engine's dominance and could have major implications for big tech. Siding with the Justice Department in nearly 40 states, the judge ruled that Google violated antitrust laws and bolstered its monopoly by paying billions to be the default search engine on Apple and Android cell phones. The judge also said that Google unfairly spiked prices for advertisers. The next step in the trial is to determine remedies or penalties for Google's misconduct. Joel Thayer, president of the Digital Progress Institute, says that the remedies have the potential to significantly impact competition and innovation online.
And so you're going to see far more competition with respect to search engines who will be able to more easily negotiate with other browsers and other texting ad markets. So in a lot of ways, this is actually an extraordinary positive development, I think. But again, I'm hesitant to say exactly how this will look in a general sense until we see what the remedies are at the end of the rainbow.
The proceedings for remedies begin next month. Google has promised to appeal the ruling. It's the first major anti-monopoly ruling against a tech company in more than two decades and will likely influence other antitrust lawsuits currently pending against Google and other tech giants like Apple and Meta. 1 year ago this week, wildfires broke out on the island of Maui in Hawaii. It was the deadliest wildfire in modern U.S. history, and many survivors continue the long process to rebuild their lives. Dry and gusty conditions started the fires on August 8, 2023. The most devastating damage happened in Lahaina, the former capital of the Kingdom of Hawaii. The blaze killed more than 100 people and displaced thousands. A year later, many of these survivors still struggle to find work and housing. During this difficult year, many relied on their faith, including Tonada Lolesio, principal of Lahaina's Sacred Heart School. You may remember her from Mark Iron's previous reporting on the wildfire recovery. Though the fires heavily destroyed her school, she worked to keep the community together and help students adjust to a makeshift building. And now her students have moved to a more permanent building at a local resort. She shares the impact it has had on the students.
This is their story, too. This is their journey. And, you know, I hope and pray that, you know, we have been able to bring that support, but also to build up their faith, to evangelize, so that one day they too, in times of crisis and disaster, can reach out and, you know, be the living body of Christ to others, to give them hope and to, you know, to put them back on their feet.
The National Catholic Education Association honored Lolesio with an award for her commitment to her students and community. She says the ultimate goal is to move the school back to Lahaina. And in Rome, what looks to be an impossible August snow shower. Pope Francis joined in the city's annual celebration of the miracle of the snow at the Basilica of St. Mary Major last Sunday. Tradition holds that Mary appeared to a 4th century Roman nobleman in a dream and asked that a church be built where he found snow. He went out and searched the next day, and after finding the miraculous summer snow, got to work on building the first church dedicated to Our Lady in the Western world. The Basilica calls to mind this miracle every year by releasing delicate white rose petals from the ceiling, a unique and beautiful celebration of our Blessed Mother. When we come back, food for the soul.
I came out of prison 10 years ago, 2014, and 10 years later, I'm running a multi-million dollar kitchen.
It's not just the food he dishes out, but also the inspiration to others seeking a new life. From food truck to restaurant to helping people pick themselves back up. The ingredients that make up this priest's recipe for life when we return. Finally tonight, if you are a frequent viewer of the EWTN network, you may be familiar with the popular program Savoring Our Faith with Father Leo Padalinghug. And if you don't know who Father Leo is, you need to know about his food ministry and how it reaches so many. Reporter Colin Flynn has our story.
Okay, y'all. So I'm just warming up some pasta so that even though we're doing buffet, I like to make sure that the food is nice and hot. So we call this just warming it up a la menu at that minute. And so We are ready to plate this. Can I get a half pan, please? A disposable half pan?
It's not often you see the chef wearing a priest's collar in the kitchen of a busy restaurant.
I think the most important thing is to know that we are dealing with something very precious and delicate, and that is feeding people. And it really is a great gift. That's why Jesus showed his presence feeding people. And when we do that, we show love. Yes, egg rolls for 5 minutes. Make sure you time that, please. I don't want it to burn. All right, we're ready to just put these out. Now these are definitely hot enough.
Father Leo Padilihung is not your regular priest.
Keep the rest
fast talking.
Actually, I'll do it right now. I'm doing it. I've got my hands in it.
Fast moving.
Okay, y'all.
And with a passion for food.
Tastes so good, right?
And in his new bistro restaurant in downtown Baltimore, it's also a place where Father Leo wants different worlds to collide. The well-off customers and the staff he employs.
We just need it because, I mean, this thing isn't doing much for me.
Father Leo employs those who have been in prison and need a second chance in life, or those from disadvantaged backgrounds who need a helping hand.
Chicken looks good. It's cooked, finally.
Father Leo's fun. He is nice at times.
At times? At times. There he is over there.
22-year-old Emmanuel is one of those employees who grew up in a dangerous neighborhood right here in Baltimore.
I always wanted to try to be a chef, and I guess this is just getting closer towards that step, you know? School really wasn't really my thing back in the day. I was a troubled kid, you know, like, wasn't really focused. Just my head, my mind focused on all the wrong things.
What are the wrong things?
Streets, girls, drugs.
So you taking drugs as well?
Yeah. What type of drugs? It gets dark, man. Every night is somewhere around here, somebody getting shot. And the life that I was living, yeah, I was pretty much either going to be ended up in jail or dead. If I didn't change it, I was going to be dead or in jail. One day, I just had this, like, realization of, like, if I keep going down this path, I'm going to amount to nothing.
The idea for the restaurant was born in the back of a truck, a food truck.
You know, on this truck, it's a mobile kitchen.
Yes, so you hear everything. Everything bashes and bangs.
Listen, when we first got it, we didn't realize that we can actually close that door. And sometimes when we hit a speed bump, it honestly sounded like the end of the world.
The former mail truck, now a food truck, has become a regular sight around Baltimore's more underprivileged neighborhoods, dishing out full plates of food and faith.
By the way, this is where we sometimes service. I'm going to just pull over just for a quick second.
And again, Father Leo's employees on the truck are former convicts or those who need a helping hand in life. And unfortunately, here in Baltimore, there are many.
In a part of the city that is so close to the financial area, but just right outside a couple blocks, there are a lot of homeless camps. There's a lot of problems with drugs and alcohol. Right behind us is the jail.
Does it ever get disheartening, Father Leo, when you do the best you can, you do so much, you put your heart and soul into this and your money as well, getting things like the food truck, but the problem doesn't seem to be getting any better?
No, sometimes it feels like it's getting worse, and it just really reminds me that what we're doing is we're just putting a Band-Aid on a situation, but maybe if with just one of our staff members we can get to the core of their wound and heal them, we know that it can change their life.
What is that wound? What is there at the core of it that is broken?
For every person, we've discovered that it's a little different, but really, ultimately, it comes to the experience of not being loved. They just don't know that it's okay to admit you're broken.
When Father Leo saw how successful the food truck was and how lives could be changed, he knew he wanted to help more people.
So in order to grow the food truck's efforts, we're going to use this restaurant space as our commissary, but also turn it into a place where we can keep people hired throughout the year and also continue to do our mission and also just bring people from all different backgrounds to celebrate around food. The mission of the nonprofit organization that I hold is the Table Foundation, and we say our mission is to harvest the power of food to do good.
So when Father Leo got the opportunity to rent this space in Baltimore's Little Italy, the GastroSocial was born.
What do you all think of this place?
Empowering really others is. To see a different path in life.
It's got a real cool vibe to it.
He teaches us how to cook, but he also teaches us, like, other skills, too, like communication, because normally I'm, like, inside of a show. Like, I'm doing something I wouldn't normally do is talking to you, you know, because I would have just been right here quiet. But working with Father Leo, he got me out of that show, made me get more comfortable talking to people. I always believed in God. I never got, like, too deep in my religion, but I always knew there was Jesus, you feel me, was always had my back. That's why I'm here today. A lot of my friends are in jail, some dead, and I'm here, no record, I've never been locked up. Like, it's, you can't tell me that ain't Jesus.
Close by in the city of Washington, D.C., Stephen Albright is the executive chef in a popular restaurant called Cuba Libra, looking after around 50 staff in the restaurant.
So, Steve, this is the place.
Yeah, Cuba Libra restaurant. Welcome.
Wow.
He is a former employee of Father Leo's, who gave him a job and took a chance on him when no one else would, after he was released from prison.
I became incarcerated in 2007 for an assault. I went to prison for 6 years. I came out of prison 10 years ago, 2014. And 10 years later, I'm running a multi-million dollar kitchen and a operation here at a restaurant. I was really hoping that someone would give me an opportunity just to wash dishes in a kitchen. Luna, how are you today?
Like so many others, after coming out of prison, he didn't see much hope until he met Father Leo.
What are we doing with this? I'm getting goosebumps still. Every time I talk about how God has worked in my life, just with the introduction of Father Leo, learning to forgive myself and learning that God forgave me.
If our spirit is broken, if we have anger in us, guess what shows up on here?
What is it, Father Leo, that makes this ministry so important to you?
For me as a Catholic priest, the most important thing that I have in my life is the Eucharist. It's food. And if I receive that, I'm supposed to, as Mom would say, become what I eat. And so I just know that offering food to those in need and also feeding those, not just who are hungry in body, but mind and soul, really changes people.
The body of Christ.
Never in my life did I think when you know, that I'd be standing here now in this kitchen as the boss.
Do you believe that this is God's doing, you here working today?
There's no other reason. I am here because of God. There is no other way. The future is to remain sober, stay close to God, you know, do what the next right thing again, as always. Take care of my daughter who's, you know, happily married and, you know, so forth. But
and keep cooking.
And keep, listen, you gotta eat.
In Baltimore and Washington, D.C., Colum Flynn, EWTN News in Depth.
Thank you all.
Father Leo's program, Savoring Our Faith, can be seen right here every Saturday at 4 a.m. and on Sundays at 4:30 p.m. Eastern Time. And that's a wrap on this edition of EWTN News in Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro. Be sure to tune again same time next week for more news and reports important to your Catholic life. Until then, God bless.